and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. This is a listener question show and comes from Neil in New Jersey. His questions are related to gardening. To get us started, thank you everyone who's made a financial contribution to the show. I'm glad to know you're getting enough value out of it to consider giving the show a hand. If you'd like to do the same, there's a donate button on the main page at thepermaculturepodcast.com. Second, if you're into social networking, please like the show on Facebook. You can search for the Permaculture Podcast, or if you'd like, the direct link is facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. Now, on to the questions. For Neil, if you're listening, these are expanded some from the email that I originally sent you as a response. Also, for those of you listening outside the U.S., some of the numbers and supply houses or places to look for things I mentioned later may not be applicable. If you have any suggestions, please stop by the site and leave a comment in the show notes. Number one, is it bad to buy non-organic plants for your home garden? I know this isn't ideal, but since I wanted to get a few more veggies in the garden, I just bought a few from the local Agway. Now I'm wondering if that was a bad thing to do. Well, for me, organic versus non-organic isn't a huge concern because they're only non-organic now. If you save seed and propagate your own plants in the future, then you'll have organic plants in succeeding generations. More importantly here to me is checking that the plants are not hybrids, as they may be sterile or will not breed true from seed, so they're not as useful to us when it comes to saving that genetic material. When I look for plants or seeds, ideally it's for organic, non-genetically modified, open-pollinating non-hybrids. But that's an ideal, and I kind of work down from that list and try to match it as closely as possible. But here I'll admit that I have some plants that I purchased that are in my garden that are of unknown origins. Because the spring weather here in PA has wrecked many of our garden plans. I've had all kinds of things damp off and die, other stuff that rotted in the ground because of how wet it got, of course with pests and everything else. So I have the opportunity to buy some plants. Is it perfect? No. But I try to be realistic in my choices, and given the trade-off of time, money, and preferences, I'd rather have certain plants in my garden that I'm growing and contend to than to have to purchase them from the grocery store. Really, a bigger concern for me are genetically modified organisms and patented plants, but they're just not my bag. It's not that I'm concerned that they're going to escape into the wild and bring about some kind of genetic doomsday, but I don't like that these genes are owned by someone. This doesn't help add to our diversity, but rather limits it because we don't have free access to the information in that plant. When you combine that with some of the stories about folks who have been sued because their plants become cross-pollinated with patented genes, this is also just not us taking care of one another. And it's just nonsense because it makes no sense. Question 2. Should I get my soil tested to see how I can improve it? I think if it's available to you, everyone should do soil testing. In the long run, it isn't very expensive, and it's a good place to start with a little bit of empirical data and gives you a better idea of what plants you can grow, what amendments you're going to need to make, and what contaminants may exist in your soil. The basic tests that I recommend are an NPK, your nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, along with your pH and lead. The first two, the NPK and pH, you can get home tests for that are pretty reasonable. Around here, last time I was out, I could get everything you needed for both for about $20, though the NPK tests usually come with chemicals that you're going to need to replace at least every year. But if you're in the United States, we also have the state extension offices where you can go and get test kits and mail them in to have a full soil test done. My local extension office sells the kits for, I think they were $9 the last time I bought them. And when you mail them in, that'll give you the basic NPK, but they have a checklist of other things that you can have done to the soil while the lab has it. If you're in an area and you don't have access to an extension office, you can't get to one easily, you might call the state land-grant university that works with the extension office and see if they'll mail them to you, or you can work with an environmental lab, in which you may be able to find in your phone book or with a search on the internet. I happen to have one not too far from where I live, and their cost for testing is comparable to what the extension office charges. And in that case, I can drop off my samples in the morning if I want to rush it, have my results back in just a couple of days, if I just let them take their time, usually about a week. And if I have any questions afterwards, there's a real person who I can call or stop back into that office to talk to. And I recommend lead testing because it's one of the most common soil contaminants here in the United States because of leaded gasoline, the use of lead arsenic pesticides, there's a pretty good chance of having some contamination if you live in an urban environment, a place where there's a lot of heavy truck traffic, or if the area where you are is a converted orchard. And though there doesn't seem to be a lot of risk of lead being taken up into the plant, there's a real concern more about children being in the garden, pulling up an onion that's planted there in the soil. They just pop it in their mouth without washing it and expose themselves to lead. As a father of small children, working in the community with children, it's a really inexpensive test and worth having done. And then if I have the lead testing done and that number comes back as high, or if there are any environmental factors that give me a concern where I'm going to have to worry about heavy metals, PCBs, or other contaminants, then I make a decision about what else to do. But again, this is balancing my testing decisions about with the information that I have on hand. Because a full spectrum soil analysis, the last time I checked, is almost $1,000. And I can't really do that everywhere that I am. So it's weighing the costs and benefits. Why these are the basic tests that I have done. Because they'll run me $25, $30 per location where I take a sample, which seems pretty reasonable, and lets me know exactly what I'm working with. Question 3. I understand there are a lot of things we can add to improve the soil, such as manure, veggie scraps, coffee grounds, etc. However, is it good to use these if we don't know if they're organic or not? What I've found so far is that improving soil with amendments, especially things like manure, can be touchy if it's from an unknown source. The issue, as it's been presented to me and from my readings, isn't necessarily about what's in the feed for manure, but what else may have come up with it. With horse manure, I've heard about problems with the bedding that the manure is collected from being contaminated with something that was detrimental to the garden. As with anything, if there's any case for concern, look for another source that you can get more information on that you don't have questions about. Use your own compost. Find a company with amendments that you can trust, whether that's a local provider who's making their own or purchasing bagged amendments from your big box DIY or garden center. Importing these outside resources, again, isn't perfect, but if you're just getting started, it can't be expected that you're going to have all of that available. Of course, my favorite soil amendment is homemade compost, because it's made from all the resources that I have available within my own site. It keeps it local, and I don't have to buy something, use it, and just go through this continuous cycle. If you haven't started your own composting system, whether that's a worm bin inside your house or a bin in your yard, give it a try. Get it started. It's really not that difficult, and I think one of the best things you can do for your garden. And best of all, you'll know exactly where it came from. Question 4. Any tips on making or obtaining supplies to build a raised bed? I find that how much money you can save on building a raised bed depends on how much work you want to put into finding it. It's easy to go down again to your local DIY center and just be like, okay, here's what I want. Pack it up. It's all in known lengths, everything else. Take it, pay for it. You're done. But if you don't want to go that route because of the need for using new material, you'd like to reuse something, or just try to save yourself some money on it, check your phone book, check the internet, and try to find a local sawmill and call them and see if they offer rough cut lumber, seconds, or odd lengths. Also, check with construction companies to see if they ever have scrap available after a job that you could pick up, or what they do with their construction waste. I know around here, tipping fees for construction material at a landfill is very expensive. The landfills that are accepting that kind of waste are limited and quite a haul from this area. So you may be saving them money in the process, and they may be willing to give it to you just to get rid of it. And though barn boards around here are popular for furniture, I've heard folks talk about seeing a barn blow down and asking the owner if they can have some or all of the wood if they haul it away. But if you can't find a resource like this, talk to your local garden clubs, if you have other friends who are interested in gardening, and see if you can go together and do a group buy of a large amount of material that you need, and then approach your local home improvement center or lumber yard and see if they'll give you a discount if you all pitch in together. When it comes to filling your raised beds, if you need to import material, try to get it in bulk from a lawn center or an excavating company. You'll be buying by the scoop or cubic yard, which usually when they're addressed, they're more or less equivalent. Around here, prices run around $20 for a scoop of topsoil and $25 for a scoop of screened and processed compost. That's about 27 cubic feet of material for less than $1 a unit compared to buying it by the bag, which is anywhere from 1.5 to maybe 3 cubic feet, and you're paying $3 to $5, $8, even $10 a bag. The savings are substantial and can add up pretty quickly. And in a lot of cases, the delivery fees from your bulk companies isn't that high. My local excavation company that carries mulch and soil charges $5 to get it to me. And they can deliver, I believe they said 16 scoops in one truck or 20 in another. So again, not that expensive, saves you a lot of money. Though I will admit that having to have them dump it, put it into your wheelbarrow, and moving it to where you need can seem like a lot of work. After having carried quite a few bags, I think you come up about even on labor. When I fill my raised beds, I have a few different methods depending on what I'm trying to do, but I also like to experiment a lot. My favorite method for layering out a bed is something like this, starting from the bottom and working my way up. Once I have my bed defined, I lay out a thick layer of cardboard, about 1/2 to 1 inch, to keep down the weeds and grass and everything else. Then on top of that, I'm going to layer out newspaper. Not a whole lot, 3 or 4 sheets thick. This is just to help give an even surface over the cardboard and help block any places where the edges of the cardboard didn't overlap well and to keep them from shifting. On top of my newspaper goes some leaves or grass clippings to keep kind of light. Again, act as a weed suppressant and give me some heavy material to break down and provide long-term nutrients. It doesn't need to be very thick, about 1/2 to maybe 1 inch. Above that is a layer of straight compost, again about 1 inch. On top of that goes a blend of topsoil and compost as my main growing medium. This covers the entire bed, more or less as high as I want it to go. And on top of all that then, I top dress it with a mulch of straw, wood chips, or dried grass. My cardboard I pick up from a local 24-hour grocery store that does their restocking every evening. And I could pick up cardboard every night of the week if I wanted to. And they're happy to give it away because it saves them from having to run it through the compactor. And as one manager said, it also keeps them from having to take a break from stocking the shelves to take it back to the compactor. The one fellow who I work with the most is used to seeing me on a particular day around the same time, so they usually have a full cart of cardboard ready to go for me. And I just walk in, say hello, give them a wave, ask them how it's going, take it out, load up my car, return the cart, go home. My newspaper comes from my family's subscriptions. We can ask around friends and neighbors if we're running a little short and need some extra. The only thing is that it's not recommended that you put glossy pages into your garden, so those should be separated out and recycled. Thankfully, around here our recycling program is really good about picking up newspapers, even if it's just a bag of glossies. My leaves and grass clippings come from around my own yard, but I also find that they're easy to pick up from neighbors when they're doing yard cleanup. I haven't found anyone yet who won't give them away just to be rid of them. My topsoil and compost, as mentioned above, are all imported at this time as I get my garden established, though in future years I expect not to have any need to import that material. Lastly, the straw that I use I buy from a local supplier for about $5 a bale, but I only use a couple during the season, so I don't mind the cost. So far, growing my own hasn't been worthwhile for the cost-benefit of doing it. I raised some spelt a few years ago, but it just didn't produce enough stalks in the space that I have. I want to try to do some small grain production again in the future, but for now, I just buy my straw. And as for the wood chips, I can buy them as mulch from my local excavating company from anywhere from $15 to about $30 a scoop, depending on what I want. But I found that I can get wood chips for free from a local tree service. It's not the cleanest stuff around, like something that you would purchase, but it allows me to use something that otherwise he'd be throwing in the landfill, and he likes coming by to drop it off because I'm not too far from his home and he doesn't have to run his truck out to the municipal facility to drop them all off. Aggregating all this together, my costs are around $1 a square foot to set up my raised beds this way. Now that may sound expensive, doing it incrementally over a couple of seasons or a few years, you don't have a huge out-of-pocket expense at any given time, but I think you'll see as you start doing this, as you start paying attention to that Zone 1 garden, getting it together, making it productive, that the costs that you accrue will be substantially less than the benefits that you get in the food that you produce, as well as in the health benefits of eating this food that you've grown, and the exercise, and experience of being out and working the garden. I hope that helps all of you. If you have any thoughts or questions on this or any other topic, please feel free to contact me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. And until I talk to you again, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.